Anyway, so we are looking at our Radical King series this morning, a mammoth look. We're taking several years looking at Matthew's Gospel. This amazing book is about how somehow, despite the sea of confusing ideas and difficult things of life around us, Jesus is King of everything. And it's about what it is to follow that King in real life, even when you live in Worthing in 2022 or the surrounding area. It's not funny, Anthony. Anyway, today we're on to Matthew 18. This is verse 6 to 9. And this is really part two of last week where Jesus had a chat with his disciples. And it's amazing because if you remember, if you were here last week, they're hanging out with Jesus and they're arguing about which one of them is the best. It's really funny, actually, when you think about it, isn't it? It's absurd, but it's very human. And Jesus brings this child forward and he says, right, you need to be like this before God, guys. Okay? Not childish, but childlike. And he says, you need to be like this before God, childish, not childlike, which sounds lovely. God is a father, we're children, wonderful. Father's Day, we like thinking about that, don't we? God is a father, fantastic. And then we get today's passage, okay? And it's another one of those passages, a hard one. This is nobody on the planet's favorite Bible passage. It's not a fridge magnet. Nobody has ever written this in one of those nice little cards and said, I was thinking of these verses and I thought of you as well. And you just came to mind and just thought, you know, if maybe you cut off one of your body parts. And anyway, here it is. I'll read it to you. If anyone causes one of these little ones, those who believe in me, to stumble, it would be better for them to have a large millstone hung around their neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea. Woe to the world because of the things that cause people to stumble. Such things must come, but woe to the person through whom they come. If your hand or your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to enter life maimed or crippled than to have two hands or two feet and be thrown into eternal fire. And if your eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It's better for you to enter life with one eye than to have two eyes and be thrown into the fire of hell. Morning, everybody. Do you see what I mean? If you read this on its own and you don't know anything about Jesus, you'd probably think, whoa, that is some extreme religious fundamentalism there. Drowning in a sea, cutting off body parts, gouging eyes in the fire of hell. I don't want to read about this. What's any of this got to do with an enlightened modern person like me? Cut off my hand, I'd cry if you cut off my Wi-Fi. What's this about? But these are the words of Jesus. And to be honest, I personally like it when we look at this sort of thing because it's the opportunity to dig past the surface and see what he's really saying. Because the stuff he says that sounds unfair or extreme or terrible isn't when you get your spade out and dig and you see it's a story of sacrificial grace and compassion. Now, the big idea in this little passage is that Jesus is trying to prevent one particular thing. He doesn't want people to stumble, okay? He doesn't want people to stumble. That word comes out four times. Stumbling basically means falling into sin, to doing things against God's ways, to move away from faith and trusting in him with our hearts. So we need to be very specific and clear about this. Jesus wants to protect those who follow him from acting in a way that rejects God or thinking in a way that mistrusts God. That's what's going on. He wants to protect those who follow him from acting in a way that rejects God or thinking in a way that mistrusts God. That's important. The whole tone of this passage, especially if you look at the wider context, is not Jesus getting at people. It's about protecting people. He knows exactly what the world is like. He knows exactly what your life is like. And his heart attitude is, I want you to be safe. There are threats out there, and I want you to be safe. As you go about your day, every day, you will encounter things that make you have the potential to stumble, to trip up spiritually. And Jesus says, well, these things must come. It's inevitable. You'll be tempted by all sorts of things. Things that you know are coming and things that just happen to you. It's going to happen. It's going to occur. But there are two types of stumbling that Jesus is concerned about here. There's when you cause other people to stumble and when you cause yourself to stumble. And this means that it's both true that sometimes you get into a mess because of something somebody else did, and sometimes you get into a mess and it was just your fault. The first one causing others to stumble. Now, this passage assumes, I think, a set of relationships between followers of Jesus. Some will be older, some younger, some vulnerable, some in positions of power. And if you're someone who bristles at the intensity of this text, remember, it's really a warning aimed at people in power, primarily. People who have an influence on others. If anyone causes one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble, it'd be better for them to have a large millstone hung around their neck and be drowned in the depths of the sea. Woe to the world because of the things that cause people to stumble. Such things must come, but woe to the person through whom they come. Jesus is saying, don't mess with my people. Don't cause my people to stumble. Don't lead them astray, because if you do, you're going to wish that you could be thrown in the sea with a massive rock tied to your head. It makes Jesus sound like some sort of mafia boss, doesn't it? You just read that. Mess with my disciples and you'll be sleeping with the fishes. Sounds like he's saying. And it's so graphic. And let's be honest, this is not how we like to think of Jesus speaking, is it? This is not one of our go-to Bible verses. But think for a second about it the other way around. This is how much Jesus is invested in his people. This is how much he's concerned for our protection, our well-being. And it's not like he's even saying, don't physically hurt my people, don't attack them. It's what seems to us like a lesser crime. Don't lead them in the wrong direction. Don't be a bad influence. Which means he's not just concerned about our physical safety, but our character. This is about protecting our character. He's so invested in our character, he warns people off causing us problems, like a lion jealously guarding its cubs. Do not make my people stumble. That's how jealously he's invested in each one of us, how he stands for us. But what specifically is he talking about? And how do we make other people stumble, and how do we avoid doing it? Most historical commentators on this passage think Jesus was targeting particularly people who betrayed trust. So this could, for example, be somebody in a leadership position, somebody who is respected, betraying the trust of someone else. It's like if I set my children a bad example, I have to take responsibility if they copy me. They look up to me, they trust me, they copy what I do. I would be causing them to stumble if I gave them a bad example to follow. And sadly, a lot of people I find who walk away from God do so because they've had a bad experience of Christians or of church in some way, and they've been let down. And what we could say to that, well, you know, of course, that's illogical. As Christians, we know none of us are perfect. We will let each other down. That's just going to happen. That doesn't mean that God is less trustworthy. It doesn't change who Jesus is. It doesn't mean the resurrection didn't happen. People are people. And that's all true. But Christians, like it or not, represent God. And so if we get it wrong, it puts people off him. It's not his fault. It's our fault. And it happens. That's how you end up with the stumbling that Jesus talks about. It's when we train other people through what we do to not trust God. So the warning is strong. But here's a terrifying thought. All of us have caused other people to stumble in some way. I do believe that. I think we've all done it. I think it's unavoidable. All of us have got it wrong. All of us have had some sort of bad influence on somebody else somewhere along the way, if not many people. All of us have already caused other people to stumble. It's a fun passage this morning, isn't it? Moving on, causing yourself to stumble. Just to cheer you up, this is more about things that are really your own responsibility. And this is helpful because depending where you sit politically, the emphasis is usually on either blaming society or blaming the individual when things go wrong. And Jesus says, it's both. It's both. Sometimes you head in the wrong direction and the people who influence you bear most of the responsibility, especially if you're vulnerable in any way. But it's also true that sometimes it's just your fault. It's just your own bad decisions, your own lack of wisdom. You made the wrong choice. You're responsible. It's on you. Jesus pictures this in these two ways. If your hand or foot causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to enter life maimed or crippled than have two hands or two feet and be thrown into eternal fire. And if your eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It's better for you to enter life with one eye than to have two eyes and be thrown into the fire of hell. So the first example is your hand or your foot. This is symbolic of the stuff that you choose to do with your body. It's where you've placed yourself. It's like if you struggle with a gambling addiction, it's probably good to avoid standing in a betting shop, isn't it? You just don't go and be in there. If you struggle with overeating, don't go to the all-you-can-eat Chinese buffet for dinner. You're not going to help yourself if you put yourself in that position. Cut those things out. Now, I'm really glad to say no expert on this text thinks Jesus literally means cutting off body parts, okay? Nobody thinks that's what he's genuinely telling us to do. But it could be that he's saying, cut off something or someone close to you if they're tempting you to stumble. An example, let's say you have a work colleague who is attractive to you, but you or they are married to somebody else. Cut them off. I think that's what Jesus would say. Cut them off nicely, but cut them off. Put yourself in a position where the temptation is kept away as far as you can. It might hurt, but do yourself a favour. It's wise. Or maybe you have a particular friend and they're just not good for you. When I became a Christian when I was 16, I had a friend at school and I had to distance myself from him. I was young and I didn't really go about it very well. But basically this friend, he wanted me to drink too much and sleep around and get up to no good. That was his view on what I should do with my life because it's what he was doing. And I had to back off him for my own good. Again, I didn't do it very in the right way, but it was right that I just backed off. That's the sort of thing that Jesus is talking about. Second example is of your eye causing you to stumble. And this is the things that you allow yourself to take in that lead your brain in direction. Now, we might immediately jump to all the stuff that's on TV, all the sex and violence and unpleasantness that we often don't need to watch, but let's face it, often we do. And that's certainly part of it. But it's more than that, I think. It's the ideas that you're exposed to. It's what you read. It's the images on the news. If you get a magazine every week, let's say, that's full of gossip about famous people, how does that train your brain? If you read that every week, how does that get you to see the world? If you binge watch a TV show where there's no sex or violence, but everybody's just sarcastic to each other all of the time, how does that coach you in how you have your conversations? If you read books about living your best life and you're the center of everything and it's all about you, how will that mold your mind? Now, a certain amount of this we can't escape. We live in the culture we live in, and we're not supposed to just sort of isolate from it. But are there particular things that we know cause us to stumble? A number of years ago, I used to watch this series called The Walking Dead. Anybody else familiar with The Walking Dead? It's like this post-apocalyptic zombie thing. Anyway, most of you haven't watched it. Anyway, it started years ago quite violently, and it just got, with each season, it got more and more and more violent. I guess that's how you have to keep the viewers, isn't it? You just make it more and more. And I stopped watching it because I thought, even though I know it's not real, I don't need to see humans, image bearers of God, in this way. Was it causing me to sin, as Jesus said? Well, it wasn't making me go and attack people with a meat cleaver. So some people would say, well, that's fine then. But the underlying idea of humans as disposable for entertainment, I was in some way buying into. And I felt that was wrong. So I cut it out. And I think that was a good move. By the way, there's probably plenty of other things I should cut out that I haven't. Whatever is not helping you follow Jesus, he says it's far better to radically cut that thing out of your life, even painfully, to avoid what he calls in those verses, eternal fire or hell. Some big, scary, loaded words. What's he talking about? When Jesus talks about hell in this passage, he uses the word Gehenna. And Gehenna was actually a physical place. It was a valley to the south of Jerusalem, and everyone chucked their rubbish there, and it all got burned. And it was basically a smouldering fire 24 hours a day. In the time of Jesus, it had become a metaphor for being judged. So going to Gehenna meant being judged by God and there being a negative outcome. So it's not just being judged, it's judged with a negative outcome. And what some people try to do is they take a verse like this and try to make it sound nicer. And they say, well, Jesus was just using Gehenna as a symbol. He doesn't mean there's a real hell or anything. But in these verses, Gehenna is in parallel with eternal fire. And with these and other verses, it's pretty clear Jesus did believe in some sort of hell, and he didn't avoid talking about it. And this is why we bump into what for us is a very difficult thing. Pretty much everyone, in our culture at least, really does not like the idea of hell. I don't like it. Anybody like the idea of hell? No hands up. We don't like it. Obviously, we ask, if God is loving, how could this even be a thing, a possibility? And so I want to just take a few moments now to say a few things about hell. Because before we go back to the passage, this is too big a topic to just sort of skip over. So just a few moments, this is not thorough, a few thoughts on the nature and reality of hell. Firstly, hell is less about a place and more about a person. For most people in our culture, when we imagine the word hell, we're very influenced, believe it or not, by the work of the 14th century Italian poet Dante Alighieri. Dante's poem Inferno paints a picture of hell that has influenced most of the art and the films and so on that we've seen ever since. And he borrowed some stuff from the Bible and some stuff from elsewhere. But really, talk of heaven and hell is about God. All good things, love, community, meaning, joy, don't just randomly exist in isolation. They come out of God. It's like this. It's like the closer you get to the sun, the more heat there is, and the further away from the sun you are, the colder. So if you reject the sun, you move away from it, you lose the benefits of it naturally. Like if you went and lived on Pluto, you'd be cold all the time. You're further away. That's a natural consequence of distancing yourself from the sun. You lose the heat. And it's like that with God. Hell is the trajectory set away from God, fixed forever, and then moving away from all of the good that he brings. But one day, heaven, where God is, and earth, where we are, will become the same place, the same thing. God will be fully present with us in every moment. It's a wonderful promise, a future reality to cherish. Hell is the direction for people who don't want that. It's less about pitchforks and fire. It's the absence of God. It's being away from God. So any view or understanding of hell we have has to reflect that. It's about what we do with God personally. Secondly, it is dignifying to allow people the freedom to choose God or not. The caricature people have of judgment is something like this. God gives us some time. If we haven't made the right choices by the end of our lives, he casts us into a hell for eternity. We cry out for mercy, and God says, well, too late. No chance. You have to suffer. The reality is our stumbling, our sin, already separates us from the presence of God, which is the source of love and all good other things. We were created for God's immediate presence. Only with him do we thrive. But God doesn't force himself upon us. And so hell is a natural consequence of not wanting God. It's the path we automatically set ourselves on. Even in this world, you can see this, even in this world, it's clear self-centeredness makes you miserable and broken, doesn't it? We've all seen that in ourselves and probably in other people. On the other hand, a person that has decided to center their life on God moves towards increasing self-sacrifice and wholeness. And you can see both of those trajectories even in this life. The person who is bitter and refuses to change just becomes more bitter. The person who seeks to serve finds life and finds joy. But if our souls go on forever, just imagine where these two kinds of people will be, not in 20 years or 30 years, but in a billion years, just heading in the same direction. Hell is simply a person's freely chosen path going on forever. If we want to be away from God, he allows us to go where we wanted to go. It's a freely chosen identity apart from God on an infinite trajectory. That's why C.S. Lewis, the great writer and thinker, called hell the greatest monument to human freedom. If hell wasn't an option, we would be outraged. We love our freedoms, don't we? God gives us the freedom to not choose him because it wouldn't be real otherwise if we did. He desperately doesn't want us to choose anything but him, but he dignifies us with choice. Third thought on hell. Look at the person who warns us. The heaviest warnings about hell in the Bible come from Jesus himself. Jesus, who is the Son of God, Jesus, who went to the cross for the sin of the world, Jesus, who says, come to me, all you who are weary, and I'll give you rest, and all the other verses that we like. This is not a crazy street preacher with a sandwich board and no people skills. Jesus warns us about hell, not to be mean, not to instill rule by fear. He doesn't want people to end up there. He doesn't want us to eternally collapse in on our own self-centeredness. He died to get us. Jesus is like the doctor telling us that we're very sick, but there's a wonderful and entirely free cure if you want it. You don't resent your doctor for telling you that. You give them a hug. You're probably not allowed to, but you know what I mean. Then fourthly, beware of thinking that you are more gracious than God. Beware of thinking that you are more gracious than God. At the heart of a lot of objections to the idea of hell is a sense that God is somehow ungracious or unloving if he allows it to be. We should be very wary of critiquing a God who came into our world, experienced separation between Son and Father, in fact, faced hell for us, and who knows the intricate realities of all this far greater than we do. We are not more gracious than God. We are not wiser than God. We are not more loving than God. And when we don't understand all this, we have to remember who he is and who we are. So that's a few very limited thoughts on hell. Do come back to me if you want a conversation about this later. I'm aware it's a bit of a heavy one. We haven't got any more time. Back to the passage. It's full of warnings, but warnings always tell us the ideal because it's meant to be the opposite thing from what's being warned. So let's end this on a positive. What does Jesus want to happen instead of the things that he warns about? I think you could put it like this. He wants us to walk rather than stumble. One way the Christian life is described in the Bible is that it's a walk. Why a walk? Well, God doesn't want us to sit and do nothing, and he doesn't want us to run and burn out. It's a rich, consistent walk with the King of the universe. As we speak to him, we follow in his ways, we enjoy relationship with him. If we don't stumble, i.e. sin, what are we free to do? Walk without interruption, to enjoy life as God intended. Stumbling is inevitable, but walking is the goal that he has for us. And so Jesus is saying in this, avoid the stumbling because walking with me is far better. It's far better. Next, he wants us to be a good influence rather than a bad influence, obviously. Causing other people to stumble is a terrible thing, more than we often think, because our influence forms how other people see God, for better or worse. But what if instead of causing people to stumble, we helped them to walk? What if our influence was spiritually good? One of the greatest joys in life, I think, is seeing that you've been somehow some sort of good influence on somebody else's spiritual life. Like you find out that the random thing that you said to them impacted them, or your hospitality gave them a model for hospitality themselves, or that sharing your story of faith in suffering helped them when they suffered too. That whatever it is you did made them motivated to love God more and follow Jesus better. This is why the Christian life is not just me and God. That's modern Western individualism. No, it's us together as a community using mutual influence to sharpen one another and move us towards God and not away from God. Jesus also wants us to enter life rather than Gehenna. He's desperate for us to enter life. That's his way of wording it, enter life. And when Jesus spoke about eternal life, he didn't just mean time, like year after year forever. He meant quality of life too. He doesn't want Gehenna for us. He doesn't want us to build our own hell on our own selfishness. But this is not an invitation simply to be nicer, more moral people. The invitation is to put the weight of our lives on him again. Put him on the throne. Say, it's about him. It's not about me. The strange counterintuitive power of Christianity is that we gain our lives by losing them. We find our identity and our purpose and our home, not by looking for ourselves, but looking at him. We enter life in our daily experience by walking with Jesus. We make him the trajectory, the destination, the guiding star. And then finally, and this is a really curious thing, we've got to see that he's the true stumbling block. Jesus wants us to avoid stumbling, but he's a stumbling block. A few decades after Jesus said the words of today's passage, somebody who was there, Peter, one of the disciples, wrote this. To you who believe then, this stone is precious. But to those who do not believe, the stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone, and a stone of stumbling and a rock of offence. I wonder if Peter smiled when he wrote this. As you go about life, you will need to bump into Jesus. You will bump into Jesus. And depending on how you view life, he's either a precious stone or a stumbling block. If you're busy with you, he's a stumbling block. He's in the way. He's an inconvenience to your grand plans. But if you know who he is and you embrace him and you trust him, he's a precious stone. He's strong and beautiful and valuable. That's what he becomes. We have all caused others to stumble. We've all stumbled ourselves. But Jesus took on the millstone, so to speak, and went to the depths and died for us. He took on the living hell of separation from his Father for us. He gave us a way to enter life just as he wants for us. And so if you don't know him, you need to trip up on him. All your plans for yourself and your glory need to be disrupted. He is the stumbling block. What are you going to do with him? But if you already see him, you already know him, you know he's the precious stone. Hold on to him.